Now I cannot recall how it actually happened, but it wasn't by some grand decree. It's like trying to explain why nobody saw it once everyone started to see that the world was much smaller than ever before. And over there wasn't so far anymore. What we did unto others washed up on our shore. The answer was hard to ignore. The end of war. The end of war.
Good evening and welcome to Peace Talk, a production by the Juneau Chapter of Veterans for Peace for K2 Radio's Focus on Community. This is VFP's contribution to our community's ongoing conversation about war and peace and the important issues and questions they raise in our community and around the world. I'm Rich Moniak, your host for tonight's program, and we'll be talking about suicide and veterans. And in the studio with me is Ray Pastorino. Ray lives in Juneau and is a visiting professor at Alaska Pacific University's Doctoral Psychology Program. He previously served 15 years as Director of Behavioral Medicine and Humanities at Sisters of Providence Family Medicine Residency Program and Outpatient Clinic in Anchorage, Alaska. Prior to that, he was the Vice Chair of the Family Medicine Department at Idaho State University in Pocatello. He obtained his MA in Clinical Psychology at John F. Kennedy University and his PhD from Saybrook Institute. He also earned a Juris Doctorate from the University of Iowa's Law School and was a defense attorney for military personnel overseas, including Vietnam. Welcome to the show, Ray.
Well, thanks. Thanks, Rich. Nice to be here.
So we'll be talking about veterans and veteran suicides. And according to the Veterans Administration, there are about 22 veterans committing suicide each day. That's about double the civilian suicide rate in this country. But statistics don't tell the story we need to hear if we're to help prevent future tragedies. No spouse, no parent, sibling, or friend will be consoled by statistics. And every soldier contemplating suicide needs attention in a unique way. Noah Pierce is one soldier who served his country and didn't get the help he needed. He grew up in a small Minnesota town and enlisted in the Army soon after 9/11, just before he turned 18. Noah served two tours in Iraq, one on the front lines during the 2003 invasion, and then again in 2005 in a city about 40 miles from Baghdad. He was honorably discharged in 2006. In late July 2007, Noah Pierce took his own life. He is one of hundreds, perhaps thousands, of Iraq war veterans who are not officially casualties of the war. Joining us now on the phone from Santa Rosa, California, is Dale Pierce. Dale is Noah's father, and we want to offer you our condolences for your loss, Dale, and tell us what happened to Noah.
Oh, Noah was raised in a mining town. He spent summers with me and ended up getting out of high school and decided to serve his country and signed up for the military 2 days after September 11th. Served, like you said, two tours. And for all his hard work and dedication, him and thousands of other soldiers in Iraq were given... On top of all the trauma they went through with the war and such, they were given water right out of the Tigris River, which was heavily contaminated. So that set the tone for just a chronic diarrhea. Coupled that with the PTSD from the killing in general, and then released from the military after his service. He came back with probably a vocabulary of a few hundred words, a lot of grunting and groaning. It was just beyond belief to even recognize that as my son. And basically, he isolated himself, and the writing was on the wall.
What was the largest difference you saw in Noah, Dale?
The guilt, you know. The war was based on lies, and you know we all agreed that the oil would pay for the war, and off they went. Well, killing people is serious business. My dad fought in World War II, and as as bad as Nazis were and marked with swastikas and all that, he killed a pilot in a Messerschmitt and saw the man die as he's coming in for a ground attack. And it ripped my dad apart. He was wanting the Luger and just the loot. That's what it was for them in that war. Was they were poor farm boys, and that gave them the opportunity. That just changed his whole life when he killed that man. So Noah was going into people's homes and basically ended up shooting kids, a doctor, people at Point Blank, and, you know, there was always the wonder, you know, I mean, you have these people defending their homes, their family, their nation. What are we doing here? You know, when he would return back from Iraq, you know, you would see pictures of Donald Rumsfeld lovingly shaking hands with Saddam. You know, that picture was taken, I think, 5 days before my son was born. So, you know, this stuff was already brewing before these kids were even born.
But he probably wasn't aware of those types of things. And did when he enlisted in after 9/11, it sounds like he felt very patriotic in doing so. Did you keep in touch with him a lot while he was over there and see the change as it was beginning to happen?
No, I didn't. For my own protection, I had been really spending time with him. I was a commercial diver, and I was working in Costa Rica. And I'd spend the summers with him, and I was telling him, look, our foreign policy is going to get us in some trouble, you know, and with the anger that's out there, with the technology that's out there, the blowback could be severe. And I'd just as soon settle in Costa Rica. And it didn't work out, and he ended up in Minnesota. So when he went, it was very difficult for me to accept that he got sucked into that thing. There was a lot of questions concerning how we got into that war, the whole war on terror, unanswered questions, and we're going to war without answering these questions. So for my own protection, I just simply, when he left, I couldn't keep in contact. It was very difficult, and he didn't want to keep in contact. So, I mean, the war itself is tearing families apart and tearing America apart. And when he returned from the first tour, it was devastating. He was definitely in bad shape, and legally he should not have gone back to combat. There's no way, you know.
Dale, can you describe what Noah was like before he went? You say he changed so much when he returned, and noticeably so. What was he like before?
Just the sweetest kid with a conscience, you know. He would dole out punishment, you know, to those that needed it and be compassionate to those that needed it. Very enlightened kid. He loved adventure. He just liked a sense of fairness. So the war changed him. The initial killing really got to him, but then the unfairness really was a baffling. And a big part of it is they know this was built on a lie and profits. And they're coming home to these parades and medals and honors and just a bunch of BS about being heroes. And the way he described it was there's two types of soldiers. One, would like him, was just horrified about how cruel we could be, and the others were sadistic killers that found their niche in life and hid behind their medals. And I know that's harsh, but that's what he described, and he's a heavily decorated soldier that went into Fallujah when, you know, George Bush was looking under his Olive Office desk in a joke looking for weapons of mass destruction. So in combat, they were eating these kids up. I mean, the IEDs were precise. My son had to put his best buddy into a body bag, at least the parts of him they could find after they got hit. He had brain damage from the attacks. And he just got so frustrated that he wanted to kill, you know, anything that lived in the desert. Mm-hmm. So to desensitize themselves, the training wasn't enough, even though the new training they have is unbelievably efficient on turning these kids into killers. They needed more, so they started torturing animals. And I've got pictures of mice they would catch and tack them to the wall and just leave them there alive, and they would stone chickens, and then they would go out and do their killing. And he said it was almost sexual, killing these people. I don't know what he means by that, but it was definitely beyond anything my dad described. My dad fought in the Hurricane Forest on the Belgian border, which was the longest battle we've ever been engaged in. We lost 38,000 men. He was there from beginning to end, and he never talked about stuff like this, of being sadistic. You know, they had a battle to do, and they did it. And there was nothing like this of sadistic killing. There was looting and such like that, but nothing on this level. My son was in the article written by Ashley Gilbertstein, which, by the way, everyone should write that newspaper letter and congratulate them for just outstanding journalism in a time when everybody else was not standing up. Truly remarkable. But they discovered that these kids were going on their own little raids, going into houses and taking the money and then sending it home to us. So, yeah, it's basically they just turned him into a killer, and when he came back, I knew the killing wasn't done. And when he did commit suicide, the first thing his mother said was, you know, he did us a favor because he's so angry at all of us for being the adults in the room that sent these little kids into battle. And, you know, we really didn't scrutinize why we were sending these kids into battle. We just did it because it was revenge on September 11th.
So Dale, you're saying that Noah's experience there actually hardened him further, almost as a survival method for himself to get through it, and he became harder. And when he returned, he was extremely changed. Was he able to talk with you or family about these changes? That's one question. The other would be, what was the effect on your family of having Noah back in the condition he was in?
What was that first question again?
Was he able to talk to you?
Yeah, it was in hints. You know, you're talking about a kid that's life was over. You know, PTSD shuts down internal organs. The first one that goes is the sex organ. You know, the brain damage, on and on and on. He's 23 and his life's over. They end up in a situation like the only place that is calm for him is to going back to combat. So they take on the role of a hero and patriotic and all that. It's the only place of survival. It's the only place where they can be calm. And besides, you're hanging out in the States here at 23 and no girls are hanging with you. So these kids have just got unbelievable problems. My son engaged in the suicide driving, which is rampant amongst these guys. To take a gun out and shoot yourself or to actually kill yourself takes, I would imagine, unbelievable determination. But getting drunk and, you know, taking your car up to 100 miles an hour is seems to be the easier way to do it. But like my son, a lot of them survive, and they end up with some wrecked car, you know, after spending their hard-earned money to buy a new one they just wrecked. And life just decays. You know, my son ended up being a janitor, and at work people would tease him for having PTSD. And, you know, he went and peed on their table, and it was like he was carrying a gun at the time. Thank God he only did that.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, he came back completely angry at all of us for putting him in this situation and ruining his life.
So he was extremely angry, and he had no place to place that anger except towards people that he loved, which probably added to the guilt and the dissonance he was feeling within.
Yeah, absolutely.
What was the effect of that on the family? How did you all handle that?
You know, it's ripping the family apart because we have serious questions to ask about the whole war. You know, my dad fought for sanity to create things like the Geneva Convention, and now we're just chucking all that out the window. And we're not even looking at the issues of why we went to war and what we're doing. We find out we went there on false information. No one's being held liable. They were given water out of the Tigris River. No one's being held liable. So what's happening? These kids are coming back with these questions. And it's going against what we're taught on television. And so as I have family members that have shouted us down, you know, how dare you ask questions about depleted uranium, or so what about the water? It's, you know, war is hell, and so what about the questions of war, you know? we're not being very, a lot of critical thinking going on. So there was an incredible amount of anger. I mean, I don't know how many people my son killed, but it was quite a few. And I'm finding out that, you know, 10, 20, 30 people isn't unusual for some of these kids. So, yeah, the effect on the family in America is tough. You know, you go out to enjoy yourself somewhere and some loudmouth is talking about, you know, how we should just, you know, keep bombing these people without even knowing that 22 soldiers are dying per day or how much we've spent on these wars. So it's tearing America apart, and until we have questions on how all this originated, I mean, we've given up our Constitution. I just talked to Susan Lindauer last week on an interview, the first non-Arab arrested under the Patriot Act. I mean, she looks like Betty Crocker. She had some information they didn't want to get out, and so they arrested her under the Patriot Act. So my son was really angry, like, who's he really fighting for, us or the corporations?
Well, Dale, he also had you suggested he was very sensitive and thought of others, and I saw on the internet a site where he had a dozen or so poems published, that he wrote. There's one that was on the article you mentioned, which, by the way, was published, this article about, a very lengthy article by Ashley Gilbertson, was published in the fall of 2008 in the issue of fall 2008 issue of the Virginian Quarterly Review. Was he writing poetry before he left? The poems I saw certainly expressed a lot of frustration and anger and was a cry for help. And it doesn't seem that he could have possibly been writing these if he was just totally mad all the time.
I don't recall him doing any poetry. He was pretty much, unfortunately, out of my life the last teenage years of his life. Me and his mother divorced, and they moved away, and I was basically working offshore. It was a very difficult time for all of us. But all the poems I know about are centered on war. I mean, he put a lot of thought into it, obviously.
Was he able to get help, support, or did he not seek support for the issues he was having?
Basically, you know, these clinics they set up just don't work for these kids. They're so traumatized by the time they get an appointment and drive all the way. He had to commute, you know, 3 hours into Minneapolis or something like that. Then you've got to wait in some line in some big building, and they just can't handle it. You know, they'd be better off getting some field tin out in the field and putting some artillery pieces out there. You know, I mean, these kids are rattled. It's beyond belief the stunning effect that you hear and see when they get come out of combat. So he would get these appointments and he just couldn't deal with it. He just couldn't deal with coming up with the images that he had done there. You know, I put myself in his position, and it was pretty obvious that he had no other choice but suicide, and it was the longest wait of my life. It just went on, and, you know, you try to get him help, you try to talk, you do the research, and it just wasn't going anywhere. So there's 22 families a day feeling the sting, and I'm surprised there's not more asking these questions, you know. Who poisoned these kids? Who put them into these combat situations?
And as I understand it, 22 per day, this is probably an underreport on what is actually happening.
More than likely. I was doing some volunteer work, and I found some guys that could still commit suicide from Vietnam. Recently talked to a guy that had literally, like my son, he was angry at all of us for letting this happen, and he's driven his car now through two different homes, just simply picked them out and at random and drove his car through them. He lived each time, got simply written up for a DUI or, you know, an accident or something like that. They're not calling it what it is, and that's suicide driving. And what I notice a lot of these veterans is they're angry at us. They're angry. They were young kids going into war, and we were the adults that sent them there without scrutinizing these facts. So it's really tough on these kids. They want to be honorable and heroic, but they know that they went over there robbing that place for the resources.
From reading the article that you mentioned, you just spoke to him driving into two homes. He also drank heavily, which was, and I think the article suggested that he was actually trying to kill himself with alcohol as well. And these are additional examples of our returning vets who are not reported as committing suicide, but many do die from automobile accidents, from alcohol, from these other problems.
I can only imagine. You know, my son said the suicide started right after the initial invasion.
Mm-hmm.
And they continued on through.
Have you and your former wife and daughter received support or help? This must be very difficult for all of you.
Yeah, I started getting help years before that. I was raised by a mother that was raised under the Nazis. She lived in Berlin, was 9 when the Nazis took over. My dad had came through Omaha Beach and, like I said, fought in the Hurricane Forest. And we were raised in a neighborhood of all traumatized families trying to raise kids that were just vacant. So I started receiving help from that. And then, you know, becoming very, very aware of the situation. And then to witness it with my son, you know, just a slow-motion train wreck. You could see it step for step.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a very long, drawn-out process. And, yeah, I actually went through what's called EMDR. And mm-hmm. I'm really lucky. It worked incredible for me. But when you're talking about a kids with, first they got, you know, the chronic diarrhea from the Tigris River, the contaminated water. Then you've just got the memories of just these little kids you've killed, the doctor, you know, the mother screaming over the husband you just shot. And then the whole thing, was it justified? So, yeah, I've had, and I'm still in therapy working on it.
So you've
learned more.
Excuse me. So you found that the eye movement desensitization reprogramming process was helpful for you?
For me individually, I went through a diagnosis and they figured that was the preferable for me, but apparently for other people it really doesn't work, so there's other therapies. But for me it was truly remarkable. It was inexpensive for the way it restructured my life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was told, oh, if we can just get these kids' nightmares to stop, but, you know, Noah just, the nightmare he described living was beyond repair.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't know if you could have saved someone like Noah. I think he saw what his odds were and what it was, and just he could never sleep. Alcohol was the only thing that could make him sleep. There's just no future. Talking to him was just beyond belief, the anger. You know, these guys are carrying guns all the time. So,
How many hours between when he was released from Iraq and when he was back in the United States? What was the time interval?
I really don't know about that one, but I do know the first time, after the first tour,
mm-hmm.
that they spent 3 days doing some sort of debriefing class where it was, you could hang out with your parents and have Thanksgiving dinner without really spilling the beans about what you were seeing and doing. But he was pretty adamant that they were seriously breaking some, committing some war crimes over there.
Did he come back with his whole unit from the invasion? And, you know, I know my son was over there 3 times, and he came back with his unit. You know, most of the groups that came back, they were celebrated with parades locally, a lot of festivities on the bases.
I think he just kind of got rotated out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, his time was up. He turned in his weapon and then came on home.
So he may have had 72 hours between when he moved from a field of action to stateside civilian life.
From what I'm understanding.
Mm-hmm.
If anyone's seen any film that's actually happened over there, that's just astounding that you could do that. These are extremely intense situations.
So I understand, too, that he had some difficulties with his sister that this is in the article that we were referring to, that was near the end of the rope for him, I guess, when he recognized he was beating up his sister.
Yeah, these guys can be set off at anything. There's guys killing their wives. It's hard to describe. He was barely contacted me at that point. He just simply wouldn't accept phone calls. Nobody could get through with him. He was becoming more and more isolated. It didn't matter what you could do. After the first tour, I had contacted my congressman, and I had a release slip for him. All he had to do was sign it, and he would have been dismissed immediately for having PTSD. He just couldn't respond. He was just sucked into it, and the environment is what he needed after the first encounter. So I have a neighbor that has a nephew that's on his like sixth tour of Iraq now. He just every time he comes back, he just can't adjust to civilian life. Mm-hmm. And apparently Noah was trying to sign up for a third tour before he committed suicide.
What happened with that?
I have no idea. Probably his usefulness was over and just wasn't fit for combat. That's what I'm assuming. I mean, when he called me on the phone, it was just shocking to hear his limited vocabulary, more grunts and groans. And you could see he came from a very specialized environment that was strictly survival.
Well, Dale, it's probably pretty difficult to talk about this, and I know you also feel it's very important to talk about, but I think it's probably a good time to take a break as well. What I'd like to do is play a song that Noah had requested be played at his funeral. It's a song by Smile Empty Soul, and it's called This Is War. So we'll be right back. This is KTOO in Juneau, and you're listening to Peace Talk.
Come to your house.
This is War by Smile Empty Soul, and this is Peace Talk on KTOO in Juneau. I'm Rich Moniak with Ray Pastorino here, and we're talking with Dale Pierce from Santa Rosa about his son Noah, who served in the Army during the Iraq War and committed suicide a year after he was honorably discharged. So, Dale, this is a difficult question to ask, but, you know, part of the story is obviously, you know, the families. We've talked about how the families struggle. What was it like, and how did you find out when Noah had taken his own life, and how did you feel, and how did you respond to that?
My second partner had gotten a phone call from Noah's mom that he had committed suicide, so her and my Noah's half brother came up and told me, and I'd been expecting it for quite some time. So actually I hadn't slept for about probably a good 2 months waiting. So you know, I hate to say it, and it sounds sick, but it was relieving. You know, there was no hope. We had gone down every avenue, and I knew what a danger he was to everyone around him. The anger, I knew he wasn't done killing. So it was just simply relief, and it was the first night I had slept in probably a month or two. It was extremely difficult. I found myself getting more and more isolated, just not being able to be around the people because I was taking on the same anger, and to be around people that just didn't understand that. So I immediately went into therapy after that, and it took about a good month to get over the shock and to you know, get back on your feet, start work again. I guess I had totally spaced out and even did my taxes for 08. So I'm working on those right now. You just simply get detached, you know, and for your own mental health and sake of others, I really had to stay isolated for a while. And, you know, I had already built a good foundation with the therapy I'd done, so I was actually able to come out of it reasonably well. But very, very, very few people will actually go in and seek mental help, let alone have checkups, you know, like they go to a dentist. So little things can really build up in people's lives, and I had been building the foundation for this. You know, I knew when he went in the war that as an invading force, the chances of surviving are slim. And then as the story started pouring in, it was pretty much you knew that there was just no surviving this. You know, the horrendous civilian casualties, the the celebrating death of innocence just because you're so frustrated. So it took a lot of therapy, and you know, the PTSD spreads. I mean, Noah would go through an intersection in his car in a rage, or another soldier, and you know, that family that he almost hit has a form of PTSD. So it just you have to spend your time doing counseling and learning from psychologists and therapists on how to deal with these issues. That's what saved me.
So you and probably most of the members of your family were certainly experiencing secondary trauma very, very intensely. You mentioned some data earlier and mentioned that a veteran is committing suicide about every 65 minutes per day. The information that we currently have is only based upon the reports from 21 states, and these do not include the larger states, California, Texas, or Illinois. One in five suicides in the United States is by a veteran, and at this time, an increasing percent, 69%, are veterans who are 50 years or older. The argument or suggestion is that they have lived with the trauma and the turmoil for many years whilst they've watched their families, their kids grow up and leave home, and now they've entered a new phase in their lives, and some of them are choosing not to continue. The suicide rate among civilians is 14 per 100,000. With veterans, it's 30. So this is a huge, huge problem. Other studies suggest that veterans from the Iraq and Afghanistan conflicts, that just in terms of ideation, 30% of returning vets report having considered suicide, whereas 45% report knowing another vet who has considered suicide. So this is a huge, insidious problem, and again, it's underreported. Probably the numbers are much higher than what we even have in front of us, and don't include people who coroners have indicated have passed on because of alcoholism or an accident. So, Dale, what do you think we can do better? What, you've been focused on this for quite a while. What do you believe we could be doing that would be better for our returning vets? Because re-entry into our communities is just not being handled very well. Earlier we mentioned the 72 hours between when a combat soldier is in place and when they're on the streets in America. So what could we do better?
I think we need to look at a different paradigm of how we deal with things. We're saying that these guys are going there to defend our freedoms and our liberties. Well, we gave those up on September, a few days after September 11th with the Patriot Act. So these kids are going into combat and coming out being labeled heroes to fighting for our freedoms and such. And, you know, I've spent my time studying this, and wars are profitable. They're unbelievably profitable. Smedley Butler, the most decorated war soldier ever, wrote a quick little book, you know, War is a Racket. We've got no big contracts in Iraq. Unbelievable money being made. And so these veterans are coming back, having fought for what they call the 1%, getting resources and cheap labor. So as long as our behaviors stay the same, the people that arrange this aren't going to change. We need to educate ourselves so our children won't go to war for the 1%. Maybe they could swing a better deal if that's the lifestyle they want to live, and get a more percentage of the booty that we're stealing. I mean, we went to Iraq for the oil, and these kids went through horrendous experiences of killing and trauma, being blown up, and we're lying to them. We're coming home and we're having, you know, like at Noah's funeral was sad. I simply couldn't go. You know, I could not go to a mock that was saying that, you know, they went over there for our freedoms. It was about oil, and my son knew that. So until we educate ourselves on how this economy works, it's just not going to change. They always know how to manipulate us into war. I mean, my dad struggled the last years of his life deeply, and he told me before he died that when we set foot on the European continent, once we got a foothold, the game was over and the stock market was collapsing. And what he felt was they prolonged the war by going into places like the Hurricane Forest. Just simply shoot it out, use up of that ammo, stick the taxpayer with the bill. The corporations made a fortune, and my dad was really concerned about that. So he studied it all the last years of his life, and that's what he told me was, you know, those people at the top will send little kids into war and make profit off of it. So until we learn what this process is, we're going to keep sending these kids into combat, and they're going to keep being used as cannon fodder for profits.
Well, and it's easy to send kids in at that age. They're young and relatively naive about what goes on in the world. Their sense of patriotism is really high, you know, after events like what the country perceived we experienced in 2001 and 2002. My son came back after his second tour from Iraq. Remember having dinner with him. He was with a unit that was redeployed to Baghdad after they were supposed to be home. In fact, some of the kids had actually arrived in Fairbanks, and Rumsfeld put them back on a plane and sent them back. Not all of them went. Some of them went AWOL. My son did go back, and he wasn't happy. He wasn't politically aware of what was going on, but you know, I know he saw things in Baghdad that I couldn't even begin to imagine. You know, and it was at the time that, you know, I had really got involved in peace activism myself. And I remember over dinner telling him that there was no way, you know, I could fathom what he was going through. But I had to say that, you know, I thought the war was wrong. And just a simple statement like that, and he just said to me, he said, Dad, he says, we all hate it. Every one of us, we hate it. You know, and it reminded me of what Eisenhower said, that only soldiers who know war can recognize it or know its futility and its stupidity. So even the soldiers who aren't aware, I think you're right. I think we need to change the paradigm of how we live, and we just need to stop recognizing them as pawns in this big game.
Yeah, you know, listen to the language. No matter where you look, there's something odd. Like Harry Kissinger was overheard at a cocktail party. His quote was, soldiers are just stupid pawns used by politicians for foreign policy issues. You know, and you mentioned Donald Rumsfeld, you know, sending your son back into combat. You know, on September 11th, instead of being in the Pentagon, you know, getting situated, Rumsfeld was out there cleaning up and helping remove bodies and such. You know, that's desertion. That was a time of war. And he's out there doing a photo ops. He's supposed to be in the bunker finding out what's going on. So as a parent that lost his loved one, it doesn't matter where I look, the water they gave our troops, the no-bid contracts, or what happened on September 11th, nothing adds up. If you want to see embarrassment, go to Washington Journal. It comes on like 4 in the morning on the West Coast. And it's where you can reach your congressmen, senators, and pundits, and our generals. And there's been series every morning of calls in asking very, very technical questions, well-thought-out questions on what happened on September 11th. And people like John McCain, you know, a decorated war soldier, knows nothing technical about September 11th. We have these questions. We would like to be treated with honor. We gave up our loved ones. We went through this torture, and we would like to just have simple questions asked, like, what was Donald Rumsfeld doing on the lawn picking up things and cleaning up when he should have been inside at his war post? It doesn't matter where you look. There's serious questions to be asked. And that's what we need to do as citizens.
Well, and I think Noah was attempting to do that. At least I see that in some of his poetry. It may not have been the bigger picture questions. He was dealing with his own. And maybe I could read the poem that he wrote about a month before he died. It was called Two Tours in Iraq?
Yes.
Yeah, I've got it right here in front of me. I guess he wrote it with a black marker on a fishing map. But it goes like this. Two tours in Iraq. Was it right? Was it wrong? I don't know. My anger destined me to hell. Now I drink. Now I cry. Relive my sleep when asleep. Relive my life when asleep. So many dead. So many killed. Now I question God. Is it disbelief or is it fear? I don't know. Don't want to die. Don't want to live, but should be dead. I'm already in hell. Two tours in Iraq. I mean, those are questions of personal torture.
Absolutely. You know, that's happening 22 times a day, you know, that we've got kids with those thoughts and 22 families dealing with it. So.
And it's so clear. There's nothing confusing about it. He's articulated it precisely. Everything's there. If you wanted to look at it clinically out of a DSM-5 or whatever, everything's right there in that poem. So I don't know that there should be any confusion about the struggles that our young men and women are going through as they return.
Well, and with what we know with some of the Vietnam veterans that are committing suicide today, you know, it doesn't mean that the soldiers that have come home. I mean, post-traumatic stress, part of the post, in my thoughts, are it haunts you later. You don't know when it's going to haunt you. Some of the soldiers that have come back and have apparently seemed to have adjusted back to civilian life may not do that. They may fall apart later on.
Yeah, and, you know, we don't understand the actual training that's going on. During World War II, it was very interesting. In Civil War, they discovered that only 15% of soldiers were actually pulling the trigger. The other 85% just refused to fight. And they started doing research and found ways to desensitize through training with these video games. And they got it up to like a 97% kill rate. But apparently they can't turn it off. So what effect that is having, I don't know. There was a lieutenant calling Dave Grossman that wrote a book on killing, and he was a clinical psychologist at West Point, professor of psychology at West Point. Very good book on killing. It explains the different PTSD for different stages. Like my dad ran manumission from the ports into the front lines and back. He had different PTSD than, say, a frontline soldier. Or my mom was a civilian in a bombing, had different PTSD from, say, a soldier in the same place. Incredible stuff. A lot of research needs to still be done on it. But we don't know the effects that the training's having on these kids. That's something that needs to be looked into.
Well, I think they call that reflexive fire that they teach in boot camp, with the idea that they'll just fire without thinking. And they essentially, I think the movie Soldiers of Conscience, I don't know if you've seen that, but the Army endorsed that film. They participate in that film, and they explain that whole process and the research you talked about from World War II. I also know, you know, post-traumatic stress, you mentioned the stigma and the embarrassment Noah felt. And, you know, it's really the disorder's a really inappropriate name in a lot of ways. The disorder isn't there something wrong. It's probably a healthy reaction to repress some of these things when you have to survive. And a difficulty is in dealing with them because you couldn't deal with them when they were going on. But Jonathan Shea is another psychiatrist who studied this and written extensively about it. He suggests it's a psychological or moral injury. He'd like to remove the disorder from the label. And that's what you see with Noah's writing. It's not a disorder. I mean, he's thinking clearly. It seems to me he's thinking quite clearly. you know, in a life that's been messed up by external forces, the disorders outside.
Yeah, it's a moral wound is what it is.
Mm-hmm. There's also research and methodology that indicates that, we're talking about the a person could be trained to be reflexive, to be reactive, to defend themselves or kill others in combat, but that doesn't take away the effect of the impact that has on a human being, the individual themselves. And you've described Noah as being a highly sensitive young man, and many people are very, very sensitive, and our brains are a little different. Some have, some of us have more sensitive, as they say, amygdalas than others, and we could identify people who are going to be more reactive to stress and violence, but so far we've chosen not to identify those persons, those souls, although they could be identified. So you're right, there are a lot of things that we could be doing and doing better.
Well, you're suggesting that the identification could screen potential soldiers from ever going over there.
That's correct. That they could be identified, that so this particular individual, when exposed to violence and trauma, will react emotionally, cognitively, much more extremely than perhaps another individual. The functional MRIs, there are studies that look into this, and it can be done, but it's an expensive tool.
Yeah, in the military, the VA doesn't have a big budget for tools like that.
That's right.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's interesting. My son told me that the kids out of the depressed areas, you know, say inner LA, the gang infested that have already been exposed to warfare, were the most efficient for get the job done, you could say. They had no conscience. They've been picked on. They've already been exposed to killing, and they had the one-upmanship with our weapons and really took delight into what they were doing. So this, you know, cheap labor and repressive neighborhoods tends to fall in good for efficient soldiers.
Efficient soldiers in wartime.
Yeah, exactly. It's mm-hmm. doing us no good here as gangbangers and, you know, the life, but apparently the ones that they can harvest into the military are extremely efficient for what they want to do, and that's dominate large places like Iraq.
Well, you make a good point, you know, that the kids that do grow up in those environments, you know, they're psychologically damaged from them. So who's to say, I mean, wouldn't you expect that soldiers who, regardless of what environment they've grown up in, would be damaged by war, the same way these kids that grew up in gang warfare are damaged?
I'm not sure the moral injury would be there. Certainly all the physical or just the added-up PTSD. But, you know, Noah had a true, true regret of killing the doctor, where other people could just simply blow it off, you know, just let God sort them out type of experience. A lot of these soldiers that are committing suicides do have either pictures of someone they killed or a note or some sort of memorable item from that person. I know my son carried the picture of the doctor on his cell phone.
Well, and I sat in on a panel, went for Lieutenant Aaron Watata's case in 2007. And some of the soldiers testifying at that was like the winter soldier hearings from Vietnam. But they talked about collecting body parts. I mean, you know, the soldiers that I was listening to were obviously appalled and disgusted with it. But it wasn't an uncommon thing. And it was people turned, the commands turned away and, you know, didn't do anything about it.
I've seen some pretty disturbing pictures coming out, you know. soldiers posing with SS flags and such like that. So it's a scary situation, and you know, my son died at 23. The male brain doesn't even mature till you're 25. So you know, these are just kids that were sent into war from guys like Dick Cheney with five referments, you know, and George Bush that couldn't account where he was during the National Guard. So,
well, and from your perspective, Dale, I think we share something. You know, with my son being over there, one of my worries was, you know, when I started to understand what he was experiencing, you know, I've read Noah's story and his poetry and listened to you, and you know, as a parent, what, do you want this your child to react to the horrors this way, or do you want them to be immune from it, which says something else that's equally horrible? You know, it's a really horrible place for a parent to be.
Yeah, you know, number one, we should scrutinize why we're going into war. We just rushed into this war, and it was kind of like we kicked in the wrong door, unfortunately, you know, an incredible amount of people died.
Well, prevention is certainly the best remedy. And what we've been talking about for a little bit here is the trauma, not only the trauma that Noah was exposed to, but the trauma that you and your family have been secondarily exposed to. The other issue, I guess, that I find myself keep coming back to in terms of what we can do better is how we manage and handle the return. Joseph Campbell, the great writer, wrote a book on the hero's journey, and it has various stages and steps, but at a very, very critical stage in the hero's journey, there is the return. They have to re-enter and return to the community from whence they came. And it's an incredibly sensitive and important step for them to go through, and just to certainly to celebrate their return is important, but then to silently and quietly listen and hold them and embrace them, it becomes incredibly important, because our cheering and validation sometimes can quiet them, and they don't have the space to say or to speak out as to what this journey has really been like for them or what they're really feeling. We don't give them the room to do that.
Well, I think we were about running out of time, Dale. I really appreciate you being on the show with us and talking, and really commend you for the work you're doing to bring these issues to light. I think with what Ray's saying, you know, we need to welcome them home. We need to listen to them. And we need to listen to those who have gone, too. The kids that have left us, even if they've taken their own life, we need to hear their stories. So thank you for doing that work.
Absolutely. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak out and get the word out there. One thing I'm asking veterans to do is, after their experiences, wherever they live, to go into city councils and keep them informed of what happened in Iraq, what your feelings are, and I think that's a good venue there. It's a captive audience, and let them know. You know, look, I like my son, think of the impact that would have had if he would go to a city council and keep them informed of what was happening. Maybe when the next war pops up, we'll ask a few more questions before we send our troops in.
Okay, thank you, Dale.
Thanks, Dale.
This is KTOO. You've been listening to Peace Talk, and we're going to wrap it up for tonight. So remember to wage peace.
The end of war. The end of war. The end of war. The end of war. We'll be right back.
KTOO-FM, Juneau's 24-hour news and information.